Welcome to EB5 Investment Voice, where attorney insights intersects with immigration investments. If you are a foreign investor, domestic fund manager, or enterprising entrepreneur and want to get the most out of the EB5 program, you have come to the right place. I'm Mark Deal, and I'll be your co-host on this journey. I'm joined by your host, Mona Shaw, and other attorneys at Mona Shaw & Associates, as well as immigration leaders from around the world. So let's get into EB5 Investment Voice. Hello and welcome back, everyone, to EB5 Investment Voice. I am your co-host, Mark Deal, and we'll welcome on to the show, Mona Shaw, your host.
Thank you, Mark. Hello, everybody. Welcome to the show. Today's show is on a slightly different topic from your usual topics. Do we really need to use escrow in EB5? What are the pros and cons? And what's the deal with bridge loans?
Sounds good.
We also, Mark, today, I'm really honored that we have as our guest on this show, Robert Slabowski from Signature Bank. The Signature Bank, is you'll know, is one of the largest banks which are involved with EB5.
Hello, Mona. Hello, Mark. Hello, everybody. It's a pleasure to be here.
Excellent. Well, Robert, now that we have you on, can you tell us a little bit more about yourself as well as Signature Bank?
Sure. I've been in the finance field for about 35 years. My background is real estate and finance. I owned my own real estate company for about 30 years, where I owned several dozen buildings and ran them as a landlord developer, and have a career now in banking, where we came across the EB5 space about 5 years ago and really committed to it early on. We currently have about $15 billion in signed escrows with accompanying PPMs, or what you would call a
private placement memorandum.
Correct. I use that term, private placement memorandum. And execute against a variety of escrow types, work closely with Mona Shaw and her law firm on many of them. A little bit about the bank. We started the bank about 14 years ago with $50 million and built it to nearly a $30 billion bank with a very, very conservative and pristine balance sheet. And in fact, out of several thousand banks, Forbes magazine in 2015 named us the number one best bank in the United States.
Wow, that's impressive, right?
Yeah, congratulations.
Yeah, there was a reason why I really wanted Bob on this show. There's a lot of nuances and there's a lot of inside material and inside stuff that only he knows. He's pretty good at this stuff.
Well, now it's going to be out there in the public and it'll no longer be really closely held insider information. Robert's going to let everybody know.
Good. Thank you. One of the other things that the bank is in a unique position to do is that because we have such a large share of the banking market, we're able to view EB5 from a bird's eye view. So we can see trends that are occurring both in the types of escrows that are used, the types of projects that are coming to market, the locations around the United States where those projects are finding themselves. And before, sometimes even USCIS sees what projects are being done on a broad scale, we'll see that being the recipients of the escrow.
Yeah, told you.
Certainly.
Anyway, Mark, let me start with, for our listeners, with a brief history of the use of escrow, very, very brief. There is no legal requirement that an escrow agreement ever be used in EB5. Escrow, it seems to be now, you know, oh, you must have an escrow agreement. Well, no, actually, it was a marketing tool. It was conceived as a marketing tool. And that was it basically back in 2005 when the first regional centers went out and they started marketing a different type of market in South Korea, in China. And again, they were trying to model themselves more on the Canadian model. So if you actually look at the regulations, there's no legal requirement that escrow be used. Today, escrow, I would say, is almost essential for a number of reasons. And I'm going to tell you about some cases where escrow hasn't really been used or has been used in a very different way. And the other thing is, because of the use of escrow, today, escrow is very much part of marketing. Many times a project will want to show off that they have a bank like Signature Bank as their bank and add that into their marketing materials.
Yes, absolutely, Mona. One of the things that we feel is a primary reason for using escrow is not only project protection, which I'll go into, for the investor, but also it assists immigration counsel in being able to track source of funds, documents, and whatnot, because the money that is coming into the country, it's making its first stop at the bank in the escrow account. And there are documents that we get when the money comes in that are useful to immigration counsel, dates, Fed wire numbers, Fed being a Federal Reserve wire number attached to an incoming source of funds. So all of those things in the tracking of the money coming into the United States is very helpful.
Well, also, if I can just jump in here, Bob, you may know, Mark, that there's been a lot of hoo-ha about the source of funds and whether USCIS is really doing their job. It came out in a report last year, the GAO report. Are they really tracking the source, are these legitimate sources and whatever? But I have to tell you that when you have a bank like Signature and they're doing their own due diligence prior to a case even being filed, that gives confidence not only to Congress people as well as USCIS.
Yeah, exactly, Mona. So when the money is coming in, we're looking at where it came from, what bank it came from. We're looking at the passports. If the money is coming through what one might consider to be a non-traditional bank, as occurs in some countries, we're familiar with what the documents should look like from those senders. So we have expertise in that. We're aware that different countries have different restrictions on the amount of wires that can go out under one person's name, the amount of currency conversion that can be done. So we're very familiar with all of those items.
Bob, does the bank actually do due diligence on a project before you accept a project?
Yes. So we reject about 15 to 20% these days of what we look at. So we have a fairly sophisticated intake document that speaks to the project. We look at the capital stack. We look at who is surrounding the project. So one of the things that we look for is who is the immigration counsel? Who is securities counsel? Who is doing the economic report? And when we see folks who are not well known in the EB-5 world, folks whose names we've never seen before, that will set off some triggers. So we'll wonder who are these folks that are surrounding the project that don't seem to be really involved in the EB-5 community. So we'll look at that. And so we do a source of due diligence on the project as well as the investor before we will accept the project and then before we will accept the money.
That's hence why a lot of projects do like to say that they use Signature Bank. As I say, it has become a marketing tool.
Certainly. As you mentioned, they were recently rated the number one investment bank, and they offer this degree of project protection because they're doing due diligence in not only the incoming funds and the source of funds and how that happens across different foreign institutions, as well as the project themselves and the key members of that project. Are they known in the EB-5 space, and how active are they in the EB-5 space, or is this a new venture for them? And I'm sure Signature Bank sees the whole spectrum of projects submitted.
We do indeed. So we see projects everywhere from real estate to transportation to infrastructure to forestry, oil. The list goes on and on. One of the things that I should also mention about our due diligence is, and this will flow into early release, but when a developer is offering his guarantee, so that the guarantee of the developer to refund denied I-526 petition is given as a means of repayment, is that guarantee worth anything? So as bankers, we can look at the financials of that developer and see whether or not there are sufficient liquid or other assets to make that guarantee worth anything, because a guarantee is only worth the finances behind it.
That's very important, actually. And I'm
definitely
going to talk to you about a couple of cases and projects which there has been major issues recently. But before I do that, one of the important things about escrow is the fact that it complies, even though it's not, there's no legal requirement that an escrow agreement is there, it locks the funds, the EB-5 funds, into the project, complying with some of the regulations. It's actually 8 CFR 204-6J2, for anybody who wants to know.
For those that are writing that down right now.
Yeah, basically what that means is that we have to show, or the investor has to show, that required amount of capital has been placed at risk and it is committed. That means if you want to put your money in escrow, you can't put that money into the escrow account of your friend or your attorney or anybody that you can call up and say, you know what, I really don't want to go into that project anymore. Can I have my money back? What the regulations state is that the funds must be committed. So that's one of the main uses of an escrow account. Now, what happens if you don't use an escrow account, like you don't really have to? Well, recently, there have been some projects which were denied. There was no escrow account, and this happens a lot. I can tell you, Mark, there's a lot of projects out there which don't use escrow, and the money is wired directly into the account. The project was denied. It was denied for very technical reasons. It could have been refiled and fixed, but the investors didn't really want to go ahead with the same people anymore and wanted their money back. Of course, when they filed the initial petition, they were guaranteed their money back if the case was denied. Here, the project principals turned around and said, well, we've used that money. It's in the project. You can have it back, but we don't know when, because we'll have to find a way to get that back to you. The investors are up in arms and upset and angry and saying, we'll go to the SEC, we're going to go to the FBI. But very honestly, there is very little they can do because they took that risk of putting the money into the bank. And that just goes to what Bob has just said about guarantees. A guarantee is worthless if you know, it's worth the paper it's written on, if it's if there's nothing to back it up.
Absolutely. Also, escrow spells out the agreement between all of the parties, and the bank then is bound by those terms. So both the developer, the NCE, the new commercial enterprise, the investor, all see that document and all understand when the money is going to be released and under what circumstances it's going to be released. So they can count on the fact that nobody is going to release money other than the bank, and the bank will never release the money except under the rules and regulations as set forth in the disbursement section of an escrow agreement. So you can literally take to the bank what's in your escrow agreement and know that what you've signed is what you're going to see.
Yeah, I can also tell you, Mark, that recently we do know of USCIS denials specifically on escrow. There were some regional centers who tried to save some money by using their own escrow. They put up their own escrow, and they also then put up an escrow in an attorney's account. But their agreement was not correct, and the independence clause really wasn't there. An attorney escrow account must be independent. And USCIS take this very, very seriously. These cases were all denied. They tried to fix it, but it was told that, you know, it can't fix it later. It has to be approvable at the time of filing. And at the time of filing, the money was not placed at risk. You know, it is important how escrow is dealt with.
It sounds like, well, through the escrow agreement, specifically the dispersal clause and how that is arranged and followed, and a bank, much like a signature bank, is going to follow that, you know, much like a robot and somewhat independent. And this is the important part of, they're really independent of what the investor may want down the road or what the project may want down the road. They're following the escrow agreement. And that, it seems like, not only does it lend itself to investor confidence, but it sounds like that's what USCIS is looking for as far as like the appropriate use of funds, the funds placed at risk before a project and investor can, you know, really move forward with a 526.
Yeah, Mark, are you you sure you weren't an EB-5 lawyer in your former life? Because you seem to have gotten on very well.
You actually do. You really are catching on.
That means I need to dial it back a little bit, because I want to make sure that if I can understand this, that the person listening can also understand tremendous. It. So sometimes I phrase this because, well, as Mona can attest, and will probably happen on the show, I often get it wrong.
So far, not on the show.
All right.
You know, the other thing about escrow is that the bank, as you say, is a disinterested party. We have no compunction to serve one party over another. We are absolutely bound to the terms of what's in front of us, and what everyone has agreed to is what is going to happen.
So now, what about the fact that a project is there, it has its money in escrow, and it decides that it's going to remain in escrow until the petition has been approved, which was the usual model.
Mm-hmm.
What happens if USCIS, as they've been doing, take an awful long time to adjudicate? Mm-hmm. You know, there's a danger to the project. What do we do then? Does the bank have any mechanisms to assist a project developer?
Sure. So there are two different ways to look at how to facilitate money out of escrow prior to I-526 approval. The first method, which is becoming less and less used, is a bridge loan. And a bridge loan would loan a certain percentage of the anticipated EB-5 raise to the developer for a short period of time. And the source of repayment would be the release of the money out of the escrow account, and prior to then going to the developer by means of something called a DACA, which is a deposit account control agreement, would first be used to retire or pay back the line that was issued by the bank.
I can jump in and say that USCIS have approved bridge loans as job creating.
Yes.
So it's okay with USCIS.
Exactly. Yeah. And we don't use the escrow as collateral. So we know that we can't use the escrow dollars as collateral for the loan. So we actually look to the project and underwrite the project for a brief period of time as we would any other facility that we would underwrite. But we do take comfort in the fact that we can use the EB-5 funds as a source of repayment. So it gives the bank comfort that it's the escrow agent and it's also the lender. And when we release the money with our left hand, we can pay ourselves back into our right before. And so it's a credit that gets underwritten favorably and with very good interest rate and terms. So,
well, Bob, let me stop you there. When you talk about it gives the bank comfort, because obviously one portion is flowing through and paying off another before it extends. Does that mean that a bridge loan, when used in conjunction with an EB-5 escrow account, may have better terms than a loan that was underwritten on the project assets without an EB-5 escrow account?
If at all. So I can tell you that.
Free money.
For instance,
there's no such thing as free anything,
free.
Mark.
No. Well, when you say at all, I'm like, woohoo, bank's giving out money.
So, yeah, exactly. The bank does not, in general course, do construction lending. We lend generally to stabilized commercial projects. But in the EB-5 space, we will actually do a construction loan that normally we would not engage in. So EB-5 is a special asset class for us, where we will do some things that the bank ordinarily does not do for the general public.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. It's all important to know, because if a project's delayed because money is tied up in escrow, they're very limited in recourse, especially if their original escrow agreement or in their PPM stated that their money has to remain in escrow until the 526s are approved. It's interesting that once the delays had actually started, some projects and regional centers had sent in a request to USCIS to expedite, and USCIS had denied the expedition request, saying that, and this is a quote from that particular denial, "It's not the government's fault that a project principal made a poor business decision." That's how USCIS consider it. If too much money is tied up in escrow and there is a delay, then there is a possibility that the project may collapse. So having a bridge loan option is always good. But other than bridge loans, what else can a project do if they don't really want to keep all the money in escrow?
Commonly now we see early release. An early release can take on several different permutations. And essentially, early release means that a portion of the money in escrow is going to be released to the project when the I-526 is filed, and a portion will be held back until the I-526 is approved. That holdback being used to combine to pay a denied investor's principal back and then give the developer time to find a replacement investor. Typical holdback these days ranges from 50% released upon filing and 50% released upon I-526 approval, which is the most conservative form of holdback, to some projects where we will release 90% upon filing and hold 10% back. The average that we see for good projects is 80-20. So 80% is released upon the filing of the I-526, and 20% is released upon the approval. Now, there's also something called critical mass. And critical mass means as a first hurdle, so before the I-526 release trigger is met, let's say there's a project, and I'll pick a number of $100 million. We will look at that project, and based upon the participants in the project, meaning who are the attorneys, who are the professionals, what is that project? Where is that project located? What is the likelihood of the developer to successfully complete the project in the time frame that he is setting forth? We will say, perhaps, we would like to see you raise 20 shares of your project. So we would like to see that 20 investors have come into this project and the escrow has come. And what that translates into is that this has now gained some market credibility. So what we know is before we start releasing escrow money, even the 80%, we have a way of knowing that there's some traction with this project and that we're not going to just get three or four investors release 80% of their money simply because an I-526 was filed, but then no more money is ever raised on that project, or the money comes in so slowly that you can't have a successful project. So by establishing a very strategic critical mass, we can really mitigate that type of risk.
Okay, Bob. So it sounds like this critical mass, I'll call it almost a risk hurdle, we'll say about 10% mm-hmm. based off some of the numbers that you're talking about. So once about 10% of the investors come in, then that could be used to trigger downstream hurdles such as early release of funds, maybe the 80-20 or 50-50, or as you said, the 80-20. We'll stick with that. So to really wrap this up in a concise way, I guess what I'm saying is before you hit that, what you call critical mass, you need to have about, say, 10% funding in escrow before you can start triggering some of those early release. And that's really as a risk mitigation mechanism for both the investors and the bank. Is that correct? Did I get that wrong?
Absolutely correct. That's exactly correct. And that critical mass is really, we pick that number based upon an individual project. And so the bank has so much experience now with seeing what works, what types of projects take a little longer, what regional centers tend to market okay. their projects faster, and we set that number. But you're absolutely correct.
So say somebody like, you know, Mona, who's obviously done EB-5 before, that critical mass hurdle may be lower than, say, an attorney or an EB-5 management team that really has no track record in space. So that critical mass hurdle may be higher.
Absolutely.
You see, Mark, again, this podcast is intended for different audiences, for investors as well as developers. It's important for a developer to know if he really wants the confidence of the investor, this is the kind of setup he really needs. And with an institution like Signature Bank, therefore, he has to understand that even if he gets his EB-5 funding, up until the time that the petitions are approved, he will not have the full funding. So he should make, or he or she should make sort of other arrangements. And as far as the investor's concerned, if they come into a project where they suddenly see these type of documents with escrow and with certain names, then they can have a confidence, a feeling of confidence that, okay, this is a project where at least someone has been looking very much at the figures and, mm-hmm. and at the people behind the project. And similarly for attorneys listening here as well, if you want to advise your clients, I think that this is an important point to know, because I do know that immigration attorneys tend to gloss over many of the offering documents and technicalities.
And it sounds like this is definitely something you don't want to gloss over. In fact, you want to put attention to early, because it sounds like it's a mix of really planning out early with the EB-5 team. And that includes the immigration attorneys, the SEC attorneys, the people doing the economic analysis and financial planning, what have you, as well as the escrow agreement and the private placement memorandum, but really the escrow agreement, because that has to be done in advance for a bank like a Signature Bank to look at it and say, yes, this is a project that we can get behind. And because of the team and because of the escrow agreement and the strength of the people and the strength of the documents, we will set better release triggers for the funds. And it sounds like it's really critical for investors to understand that escrow agreement, because if things don't come out as planned, which happens
all the time,
happens all the time. Yeah. As you mentioned, you've got 276 projects. They're not any of these scandal projects, mm-hmm. but they're even within those, there's been a couple of 526s that haven't been approved, and maybe a few of those that have even been denied. And it's that escrow agreement that everyone goes back to and says, all right, what happens to the money? So it sounds like it's also up to the investor to, you know, perhaps look at that escrow agreement, maybe even first before the business plan or the private placement memorandum or the marketing material. Well, maybe after the glossy marketing material, mm-hmm. but then look at the escrow agreement next.
Right. I have another question for you, Bob. We have projects where they have put their money into an escrow account, 100% of it.
Sure.
Now they were planning on alternative financing. The alternative financing didn't come through, and they really want to go into this EB-5 money. The PPM states specifically that the money will not be released until the 526 is approved. What about what happens if the investor agrees to sign a document after he's been asked by the developer to release his money early? Will the bank agree, even though the PPM doesn't state that?
It's really a case-by-case basis. There are times where we will ask for an amended PPM, private placement memorandum.
And that would have to be executed by all the investors,
right? All the investors, correct.
Not even just some of them, but all of them.
All of them. So when there is a change, a systemic change, where the change is not really specific to simply one investor, but where an investor is doing something that is systemically contrary to the escrow agreement and to the private placement memorandum, we generally will ask for the documents to be recrafted. And again, it is a lot of work is then cast upon the attorneys and the developers, but it is exactly what the bank should be doing to protect the interests of the folks who relied upon the document that they signed with us.
What happens if a project, say, and we've come across this scenario sure. too, that we'll have two PPMs mm-hmm. and we'll have some people who just put the money in without escrow and some who put it in escrow. Is that allowed?
We frown on that somewhat, unless there are two PPMs because there are two different countries, let's say. So let's say that you're actually going to be marketing one way in one country and one way in another country. We've seen that and we're okay with that. However, to have a bifurcated project in which some of the folks are doing one thing and some are doing the other, our opinion is that it leaves parties open to the argument that an investor could always make, saying, well, I really should have gone into the escrow one, and you know, I felt pressure to go into this one where my money was released too quickly. So when you give options where one of the options is a lot better in terms of protection, in the bank's opinion, you're creating a situation that we would like to always avoid happening.
Let me ask you this also, Bob. We have a lot of projects where the investor is eager to put his money in the project. And I know that most escrow accounts will not accept investor money until we've finished all the PPMs and the documents. And often that takes time. So what does that project do? What does that investor do?
So we have something called a reservation escrow account. It's an escrow account that the investor signs on to, the parties all sign on to. And really what it says is two things. It says that in contemplation of accepting a project, a particular project, that the investor wants to get his money lined up and ready to go into a project when all of the documents are completed. So their money would get wired to the bank into what is called an escrow holding account, reservation escrow holding account. And the escrow agreement basically says two things, that the investor is either going to direct us to send the money back to him if he chooses not to move forward, or the investor is going to execute a regular subscription agreement for a particular project when that project's PPM, private placement memorandum, and regular escrow agreement is ready. So it's a place to park money while documents are being perfected so that the investor can make sure that they reserve a place for themselves in a particular project. Very safe, because the money goes in only one of two places, back to the investor or into the project that the investor has instructed us to move it into.
Yeah, very, very interesting and good to know. Bob, you were involved, like I was, last year a lot on the draft policy formation of the new bill. And I, of course, we saw a lot on infrastructure, and this country really does need infrastructure. And I do get asked by investors about infrastructure projects, but the financing structure is different. And I know that, you know, we were trying to figure out the right wording. What are you seeing in this area, in this space?
We now have the ability to underwrite municipal bonds that are purchased through a private placement by EB-5 investors.
As wow, an example, that sounds heavy.
That's a brand new development. For instance, if there is a bridge project in a rural community that issues a municipal bond, we could use EB-5 dollars to purchase that bond for the investors.
Is that safer for an investor?
So it is a project that is administered by a government agency of the United States. So it is a government agency who is using the money with all of the oversight that brings to the table. And there's a very interesting exit strategy. So at the end of a project, when an investor is ready to receive their money back, in many traditional real estate projects, in order for the money to be dispersed to investors, that particular piece of real estate either has to be sold or remortgaged.
And I have to say, the caveat on that is that it can be sold by the developer when the developer wants to. If the price is too low, the developer will not sell, right?
That's correct.
Yeah, that's what we're seeing nowadays.
That's correct.
We're seeing quite a lot of that.
And so the investor can be left in a project where their money is still protected, but they're not able to gain any liquidity. So their money is tied up in bricks and mortar. However, with a bond, you can distribute the individual bonds to the investor at the end of the period. That investor can then take the bond and receive the rate of interest that bond is creating, or they can go to the secondary market and individually choose to sell that bond.
That's an awful lot to digest. And for our listeners, bonds is something which is up and coming. It's something which is very new. So we do have a whole podcast dedicated to bonds. And
exactly. Exactly, Mona. And in fact, Bob Slopowski, thank you so much for coming on. And Mona, you're right. We'll cover your bonds much deeper in another episode. But again, thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you so much, Bob, and keep up the good work.
Thank you. Thank you. It's firms like yours, Mona, that allow us bankers to sleep at night. Thank you.
That's the first time I've heard that one.
Thank you for being with us today on EB-5 Investment Voice. The topics presented in this podcast is informational in nature and is not to be taken as specific legal advice. If you have questions on the topics presented in this episode or other investment immigration needs, please contact Mona Shaw & Associates. Mona and her attorney staff can be reached at mshawlaw.com. That's mshahlaw.com. Or call the office at 212-233-7473. Don't worry about trying to write all this down, as it's already embedded in your podcast player of choice. The contact information and other valuable resources can be found there. I hope you found this episode valuable in understanding how banks come into play when working with money and investors in the realm of EB-5. And as hinted, we are going to touch upon bonds in a later episode. But in the very next episode, we're going to be touching upon a tough subject, and that is EB-5 denials. Make sure you don't miss it by subscribing to the podcast. While you're at it, leave us a rating on iTunes. If you really found this episode valuable, share it with someone else that could benefit from this information. Until then, I'll see you on the next episode of EB-5 Investment Voice.